The most common symbolic use of the skull is as a representation of mortality, but also with occult knowledge of spiritual immortality. Hindu temples and the depiction of some Hindu deities, for example, have displayed association with the skulls. The word Kapala is a Sanskrit term meaning skull, bowl, or vessel, and is a decorative human skull used as a ritual implement in both Hindu and Buddhist Tantra. In Tibet, they are often engraved with serpents and swastika symbology, and are used to consume blood, but not any kind, moon blood, which implies it was derived from the female cycle, particularly from a specific lineage of high priestess that represents the goddess. That said, the skull is the same color of the moon, no matter what race, and the moon is usually feminine, as it reflects the light of the sun. Now, there are cultural exceptions to this, of course. For example, for the Shinto of Japan, the sun is female. The Hittites also have a sun goddess, as do the Norse. But in an alchemical context, which is another way of saying secret or occult knowledge that had to go underground to avoid persecution, it is the moon that represents the feminine aspect. For example, the lunar cycle is associated with the female ovulation cycle. But it gets deeper than that, as you will soon discover. In the painting from 1640 called Mary Magdalene and the Smoking Flame, we see her hand resting on a skull as she stares into a flame. During the 17th century, great devotion was shown to Mary Magdalene in all Catholic countries, and while she's considered one of Christ's most devoted followers, the true esoteric reason has been hidden. There are two books placed on the desk. One of the books is the Holy Bible. There's also a cross and a rope on top of the desk. There's another famous painting from around the same time called Magdalene at the Mirror, where this time the skull is placed on top of a book, and in this version, there's a mirror on the desk. The mirror is an ancient symbol that is often seen with the goddess. Some modern sources have incorrectly attributed this to pride or vanity, claiming it's to reflect beauty, which is a false and unfortunate interpretation. The mirror is an important symbolic theme associated to the ancient goddess, just like the thunderbolts were to Zeus, or wine was to Dionysus. Besides the moon, the goddess is associated with the planet Venus, which is her name in ancient Rome, as it was Aphrodite in Greece, Ishtar in Babylon, Inanna in Sumer, Isis in Egypt, Astarte in Phoenicia, and many others. The astrological symbol for Venus consists of a circle with a small cross below it, also used as a symbol for biological female, as well as the alchemical symbol for the metal copper. And this provides an interesting link between copper, females, and mirrors, as in antiquity, polished copper or bronze was used in mirrors. Incidentally, bronze is still mostly copper with some tin added to it, making it stronger. Mirrors have always been connected to beauty and imagination, but also to secrets, both hiding and revealing them, and as such, to the intense secret-shattering aspects of light. This links back to the planet Venus, which in ancient Greece was ruled by two gods, one of which was named Esphorus, meaning bringer of dawn, or Phosphorus, meaning bringer of light, identifying the goddess of love's sacred planet, Venus, as a bringer of light, or Lucifer, if you prefer. So the mirror represents revelation and truth, and the goddess gazing into the mirror is acknowledging the truth of all that resides inside of her, and the true symbolic meaning can be summed up in the ancient Greek saying, "Know thyself," which was inscribed at the entrance to the Temple of Apollo at Delphi, famous for the Oracle of Delphi, the place of priestesses which through sacred acts could see into the future, which had nothing to do with the volcanic fumes seeping into the temple, but rather the sacred use of biomagnetic energy known as prana, chi, Orgone, and Vril, which was amplified through sacred ritual and circulated throughout the body, particularly the heart area and then the area of the pineal gland, known as the third eye. That said, in the ancient world, and even the Bible, to know has another esoteric meaning. For example, in the King James translation, we read, "And Adam knew his wife, and she conceived." But in the context of alchemy, the act was never carried out to conception. Instead, the vital life force was prolonged and then redirected up the spine rather than expelled for procreation. Back to Mary Magdalene and the skull, which is one of the most misunderstood symbols, and for good reason, as it holds a very ancient and deep secret. It often appeared with crossbones, a famous symbol which I won't explain again here as I've already covered it in a prior video, but briefly, the X goes back to the ancient rune Gibo and is a symbol for the sacred marriage, magic, the kind that's spelled with a K, and divine vision. While some have speculated that Mary Magdalene was the wife of Jesus, and others claim she was a prostitute, I would like to point out that in ancient times, the temple priestess or goddess would engage in sacred acts that were very different from what goes on today. And while it may be hard for many in modern cultures to understand because of the lack of real education and the inundation of things like porn, the ancient rites consisted of a sacred activity performed in the context of religious worship and altered states of consciousness, which in modern terms can be described as tantra, or the real esoteric original types of yoga, and certain methods of qigong. This is the real method of activating the pineal gland, the natural way of releasing DMT into the brain without drugs, and unlocking clairvoyance, and what the Taoists or original Buddhists and Gnostic Christians consider communicating with the divine or God. While these secrets are also part of the skull, it holds one other very important covert meaning, which is particular to Mary Magdalene. Since remote antiquity and until this day, skulls have always represented a pure royal bloodline that runs through the woman, which imbues a divinely sanctioned authority. This concept is directly linked to what is known as the divine right of kings, which is also called God's mandate, and is a political and religious doctrine of royal and political legitimacy, meaning a justification of the right to rule as divine nobility based on certain bloodlines. As Jesus and Mary Magdalene were allegedly part of the royal line that goes back into antiquity, which is why in every ancient secret society, there's a skull symbolism. The skull symbolizes their right to rule because of their birth from a woman of pure royal blood. The pirates had the skull and crossbone because most of them were Templars, and they were loyal to the bloodline of Mary Magdalene. They're also related to Vikings, Phoenicians, as well as the Pharaohs. When used in military context, they're just showing that they're fighting for a pure bloodline of some princess or queen, which is the true reason the Trojan War was fought over Helen, and what her genetic lineage represented. The bloodline runs through the female. And I have another video on pirates, and will include a link in the description for those that are interested. Another reason the skull is feminine, as I've touched on earlier, is in occult secret societies, men traditionally drink female monthly lunar blood in order to get the conscious powers of women to activate gnosis, traditionally from a skull cap, from a real skull, which is the real symbolic origin of the yarmulke and where the skull cap comes from. The sacred act is also the true reason for the circumcision, which stretches back to ancient Egypt and even earlier, and has nothing to do with slavery, but performed on pharaohs and the initiated, which is meant to aid in the harnessing of prana, chi, vril, for higher intellectual, creative, and spiritual purposes, rather than for expelling it or spilling the cup of Hermes. but for harnessing and for internal alchemy and building up the astral or light body or soul, which theoretically becomes an immortal vehicle in the afterlife. This bloodline is also associated with the concept of Mashiach or Messiah, which in the Hebrew Bible, a Messiah is a king or high priest, traditionally anointed with holy anointing oil, a topic which I will cover in great detail in a future video, assuming that I'm permitted to on this platform. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. You can find my published books on Amazon.com. They make a great gift. I'd like to thank those who support me through Patreon. There should be a link below for those that are interested. I appreciate it very much. Thank you. I also would like to extend my gratitude to anyone who shares these videos. Please remember to hit the like button and subscribe for updates. As always, I very much look forward to reading your thoughts in the comment section, so please leave a comment below. Have a wonderful week, and I hope to see you again soon. Before Christianity existed, there was what is now commonly known as paganism, which is a derogatory term for polytheism. Polytheism is the belief or worship of more than one god. Although Christianity is officially considered a monotheistic religion, meaning the belief in only one god, it is sometimes claimed that Christianity is not truly monotheistic because of its teaching about the Trinity, which believes in a God revealed in three different persons, namely the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. I suppose a Christian rebuttal to that would be that the central doctrine of Christianity is that one God exists in the three persons and one substance, which is fine with me, but I'm interested in this concept of the Holy Spirit, which I'll touch on again a little later. Tritheism is a word that comes from the Greek, meaning three divinity, and in antiquity, as well as in certain forms of neo-paganism, the triple goddess is a deity or archetype viewed as a tri-unity, or three distinct aspects or figures united in one being. These three figures are often described as the maiden, the mother, and the crone, each of which symbolizes both a separate stage in the female life cycle and the phase of the moon, and often rules one of the realms of heaven, earth, or the underworld. Various triune or triple goddesses were commonly seen in ancient or pre-Christian religions. In Greek mythology, Icarus is one of the three or more minor goddesses of charm, beauty, nature, human creativity, and fertility. The Greek poet Hesiod usually calls them names which translate to shining, joy, and blooming. In Roman mythology, they were known as the Graces. Homer identified them as having to do with Aphrodite, and by extension, the Eleusinian Mysteries. Initiations were held every year, and probably the most famous of the secret religious rites of ancient Greece. These rites are attributed to the religious practices of the Mycenaean period, meaning the Bronze Age, but I would argue they go back much further than that, possibly to Atlantis. In ancient Greek terms, the mysteries represented the myth of the abduction of Persephone from her mother, Demeter, by the king of the underworld, Hades, in a cycle with three phases: the descent or loss, the search, and the ascent, with the main theme being the ascent of Persephone and the reunion with her mother. The ascent of Persephone, or her resurrection from the underworld, in ancient times had parallels with the rebirth of the phoenix, an undying bird that cyclically regenerates itself, or is born again, later associated with other birds, such as the dove. We'll get back to the dove in a little bit. It was a major festival during the Hellenic era, and later spread to Rome. Similar religious rites appear in the agricultural societies of the Near East and in Minoan Crete. According to one ancient author, The mysteries were intended to, quote, elevate man above the human sphere into the divine and to assure his redemption by making him a god and so conferring immortality upon him. The details of the rites, ceremonies, and beliefs were kept secret and consistently preserved from antiquity, but definitely included intoxicants such as psychedelic drugs and sacred ecstatic forms of worship, which I'm not permitted to explain in detail on this platform. For the initiated, the rebirth of Persephone symbolized the eternity of life, and by performing and experiencing certain rituals in a certain way that was held secret, they believed that they would have a spiritual reward in the afterlife, a certain degree of what might be considered immortality. The name of the town where this festival was held was called Eleusis, whose origins are pre-Greek and likely comes from Eleithyia, or Lithia, an ancient goddess from Minoan Crete who also shares resemblance with Lilith. Some scholars argue that the Eleusinian cult was a continuation of Minoan cult and that Demeter was a poppy goddess who brought the poppy from Crete to Eleusis. Of course, these same or similar festivals are mirrored in the mysteries of Isis and Osiris in Egypt, some of the Syrian cults, the Persian mysteries, and the Phrygian mysteries. As Christianity gained in popularity in the 4th and 5th centuries, Eleusis' prestige began to fade. The last pagan emperor of Rome, Julian, reigned from 361 to 363 after about 50 years of Christian rule. Julian attempted to restore the Eleusinian mysteries and was the last emperor to be initiated into them. Another example from Greek mythology is the Morai, often known in English as the Fates. In the poem Theogony by Hesiod, three Morai are daughters of the primeval goddess Nyx, which means night. Later, they're the daughters of Zeus, and were supposed to appear three nights after a child's birth to determine the course of its life. The Fates had at least three known temples in ancient Corinth, Sparta, and Thebes. The Morai were usually described as cold, remorseless, and unfeeling, and depicted as old crones or hags. In Norse mythology, the Norns are female beings who rule the destiny of gods and men, twining the thread of life. They set up the laws and decided the lives of the children of men, and it's often been inferred that they ruled over the past, present, and future. In younger legendary sagas, the Norns appear to have been synonymous with witches, and they arrive at the birth of the hero to shape his destiny. In Wiccan traditions, the goddess takes the threefold form, and as we discussed earlier, as aspects of maiden, mother, and crone, aligned with the phases of the moon cycle as waxing crescent, the full moon, and the waning crescent, and also represent the three phases of a woman's life in terms of physical reproduction, before, during, and after the body's ability to have a child. But while a woman will proceed linearly through these phases in a literal sense during her lifetime, each aspect of the triple goddess has qualities that all of us, male and female, resonate with at various points in our lives. That said, the threefold form of the goddess could be said to reflect the complexities of the human psyche, as well as the cycles of birth, life, and death experienced by all people on earth. We see this template throughout pre-Christian history. Another example is the goddess Hera, whose mythological roles are of girl, woman, and widow. While in some cases it's a single deity with three faces, in some modern Wiccan sects, the Roman Diana is regarded as the maiden, the Egyptian Isis as the mother, and the Hindu Kali as the crone. The point is that each designation is symbolic of certain aspects of nature, such as a particular season, or maybe an element, or an aspect of a phase of life. Which brings us back to the Christian theology, where the gender of the Holy Spirit has been the subject of some debate from the earliest times. For Semitic languages, such as the ancient Syriac, which is derived from Aramaic, the earliest liturgical tradition and established gender usage for referring to the Holy Spirit is feminine. The Holy Spirit in Hebrew is also feminine and was depicted as a woman 900 years ago on a chapel ceiling in Bavaria, Germany. But when the Bible got translated into Greek, the word for Holy Spirit became pneuma, a neuter word. Pneuma means spirit and breath. In most Christian iconography, the Holy Spirit is usually represented as a dove. Doves are commonly considered nurturing and seen as a symbol of motherhood because of their unique ability to produce their own milk. The dove is commonly seen in Christian art with Mary as a symbol of care, devotion, purity, and peace. But the dove is a companion of Ishtar too, the great mother of Assyrian culture, who is often portrayed as holding a pigeon. The ancient Phoenicians associated Astarte, the goddess of love and fertility, with the dove. Aphrodite is also often featured with a dove nearby, as is the Roman equivalent Venus, goddess of love, whose chariot was drawn by doves. In Roman mythology, she was the mother of the Roman people through her son, who survived the fall of Troy and fled to Italy. In the ancient Near East and Mediterranean world, the dove was an iconic symbol of the mother goddess. Small clay shrines from the Iron Age Levant depict doves perched atop the doorways of these semi-mini temples. On one example from Cyprus, the entire exterior of the goddess's shrine is covered with doves, which represent feminine fertility and procreation, and came to be well-recognized symbols of the Canaanite goddess Asherah. There is strong evidence in the Hebrew Bible, as well as the archaeological record, that many ancient Israelites believed the goddess Asherah was the consort of their god Yahweh. Perhaps it's not surprising then that the heirs of this Israelite religion incorporated the feminine symbol of the dove to represent the spirit of God. There were many goddess temples in the pagan world. Over a period of time, as society became more patriarchal, the goddess temples came under increasing pressure to change, and their core teaching became unacceptable to their rulers, so they were forced to continue their goddess teaching in secret. So the goddess teaching became the mysteries. As the goddess temples were forced to teach their followers the teachings as decreed by the patriarchal rulers, they could only give out their goddess teaching to trustworthy followers whom they knew wouldn't betray them to the authorities. These secret teachings, which anthropologists attribute to fertility, is really a veiled reference to a sacred act, which, when performed correctly, is regarded as a way of communing with the divine and reaching a higher wisdom, a word which in Greek is sophia. Sophia, or wisdom, is a central idea in Hellenistic philosophy and religion, Platonism, Gnosticism, and esoteric Christian theology. It represents the secret mysteries that are at the core of all secret societies, such as the Knights Templar, who introduced the Black Madonna symbolism into Europe after their time in Jerusalem and the Middle East. This became known as the occult, which means hidden knowledge. Alchemy was an important part of the occult movement. By claiming to work at either turning base metal into gold or finding the elixir of immortal life, these alchemists were able to study ancient texts, practice pagan rituals, or do scientific research and still escape persecution. Because the authorities wanted more gold or a recipe for eternity, they left the alchemists alone and even financed them, hoping that they'd achieve what they claimed they could do, which was a very clever move by the secret goddess movement. By appealing to the rulers' greed and fear of death, they managed to survive. The Chinese Taoists were also alchemists, and Taoism was originally a goddess-based philosophy, but because of persecution, it had to externally change itself into a patriarchal religion. This practice was also taken up by the Sufi, which held the secrets of the goddess within Islamic countries, which at one point in time were called Aryan countries, and finally brought to Europe, surviving even in the not-so-secret societies such as the Masons. When a brother has proved to be trustworthy, he is taught alchemy as represented by the god Mercury. Then, if he is proved worthy, he is taught about the triple goddess of pre-Christianity. Then, if that is acceptable to him, he finally learns about the great mother of prehistoric times, where he will finally learn the true origins of Freemasonry. What is surprising is how clearly they show this in their symbolism. In the drawing here, we have four goddesses above a cloud on the roof of a Masonic hall. The goddess, or Great Mother, is holding the mirror of truth, who is accompanied by the three virtues, faith, hope, and charity. Below these four goddesses is the messenger god Mercury, who plays an important role in alchemy and Hermetic mysticism as the god Hermes, which I covered in a recent video, and I'll add a link to it in the description. It seems he's taking instructions or teaching from the goddess and passing them down to the Masonic brethren, symbolizing that the true inner teachings of Freemasonry comes from the ancient goddess religion. In this Masonic drawing, we see the seven liberal arts and sciences. What we have to ask is, why do women represent them? In an age when nearly all women were not given any form of education, it would make more sense to represent art and science as old men with beards, which was the usual custom in the past. But these women are bare-breasted, which would be unacceptable in real life in the time the drawing was created. So it suggests that these women were pre-Christian pagans. While it is true that many women were academics in the ancient world, the esoteric symbolism here speaks to the occult relationship between love, arousal, and creative knowledge or divinely inspired gnosis. The eighth figure completes the symbolism, as eight is the number of points on the Star of Ishtar, the primary symbol of the Babylonian goddess, as well as the Sumerian Inanna. In this Masonic drawing, we see another goddess holding up the mirror of truth. This is a reference to ancient mystery school saying, quote, "Know thyself." In ancient times, to know was a reference to the sacred act. This goddess is naked, so clearly she's a pre-Christian pagan goddess. She's coming out of a well, which is symbolic of part of the female anatomy, and water itself is also associated with the feminine. Above her head is a sun with a triangle in it, and what appears to be a dot inside the triangle, which is also known as a squared circle, in alchemical terms, the philosopher's stone, which is not really about transmuting metals or about physical longevity, but about developing spiritual divine gold and wisdom pertaining to the immortality of the soul. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. You can find my published books on Amazon. They make a great gift. I'd like to thank those who support me through patreon.com. There's a link below for those who are interested. I appreciate it very much. Thank you. Please remember to hit the like button, subscribe for updates, and as always, I very much look forward to reading your thoughts in the comment section, so leave a comment below, and please have a wonderful week. I hope to see you again soon. Have you ever looked at the Starbucks logo and wondered who or what that mythological creature was on it? Some say she's a mermaid, some say she's a siren, and others a sea nymph. In actuality, the beautiful maiden that is shown with a crown upon her head and two mermaid-like tails is none other than Melusine. In ancient medieval times, the tale of Melusine, or sometimes Melusina, is spoken in reference to a water fairy who was stricken with a condition of being half woman and serpentine, or half fish, every Saturday. The myths would often begin around spinning wheels, meaning that women were gossiping and telling stories while working. As long as Messaline's husband didn't see her on that one particular day of the week, Saturday, everything would be fine and normal. As with most fairy tales or legends, things don't go according to plan. Melusine, the daughter of Priscina, a full-fledged water fairy, and of a mortal man, King Elenus, wasn't always a mermaid. According to the myth, she was stricken with this ailment or condition after her mother found out what Melusine did to her father, King Elenus. King Elenus had met Priscina, the water fairy, at the Fountain of Thirst and fell madly in love with her at first sight and asked for her hand in marriage. Priscina agreed to marry the king under the condition that he never enter into her chambers during or just after childbirth. Shortly after the marriage, she became pregnant with triplets and soon thereafter gave birth to three daughters, Melusine, Melior, and Plantina. King Elenus's curiosity got the best of him after his elder son, from a previous marriage, insisted that he go in and see his wife and new babies. Priscina was so overcome with sadness because her king had broken his promise that she takes the babies and runs away off to a hidden island. When the daughters are teenagers, Priscina takes the girls to look upon their father's realm. She tells the girls about the promise her father broke, and Melusine decides to seek revenge against her father. She convinces her two other sisters to help her kidnap their father and imprison him inside of a mountain. Once Priscina finds out about this, she becomes very upset and punishes Melusine by telling her that she will become a half-fish or serpent creature every Saturday for the rest of her life. Melusine goes on living in the forest until one day she stumbles across a count, or in some versions, a duke, who had been very distressed due to accidentally killing his uncle during a hunt. He was unsure what to do, but Melusine gave him advice on how to go about explaining the accidental death he caused of his uncle to his family, and further promised him that she would help him obtain riches, wealth, and power, to which he could never imagine. This helped ease his grief, and he was so pleased with Melusine's help that he asked her to be his bride. She agreed under one condition, that he could not see her in her chambers on Saturdays, no matter what. He agreed to the silly request, and they were married at once. Melusine helped him gain power to the kingdom and to build up the prosperous city, where Melusine became the mother of 10 children of now a royal lineage. She even had the castle built there and ruled over the land graciously and lovingly, adored and appreciated by her people. It was obvious due to the time span of so many children being born that they had been married for at least 10 years or more when the Duke became pressured by his other family members about Melusine's odd Saturday activities. His curiosity increased when they informed him that she didn't like to attend mass at their cathedral, and so he started wondering what she may be doing in her chambers by herself. In a fit of jealousy, thinking that she may also be cheating, he peeked through the keyhole in the door to her chambers, sees her bathing in a tub, appearing very beautiful as usual from the waist up, but from the waist down, her fish or serpent-like body splashed around with a fierce tail. He couldn't believe his eyes and accused her of being a false serpent. Melusine is so distraught over the fact that he not only knew of her secret and thus breaking his promise, but also that he announced to everyone what she really was. Some books say that Melusine then turned into a dragon and flew away, while others state that she jumped out of the window in her fish-like state and swam away into the river. She was said to visit her children some nights in human form, but other stories claim that she was a bad omen, and if you saw her flying around, that meant an impending death in the land. Many French royals, dating back to the days of Charlemagne, have claimed to have descended from Melusine's family line, or at least dating back to the time when the story took place, and were extremely fascinated with the legend. For example, the Plantagenet families, Angevin lineage, and the House of Anjou and Ver still claim lineage that date back to the story of Melusine. According to the book, The Serpent and the Swan, the animal bride in folklore and literature, the name Melusine was used as an abbreviation of the words Mer, Des, Lusignan, or Mother of the Lusignans. The House of Lusignan was a royal house of French origin, which at various times ruled several principalities in Europe and the Levant, including the kingdoms of Jerusalem, Cyprus, and Armenia, from the 12th through the 15th century during the Middle Ages. It also had great influence in England and France, with some derivations of the name Melusine paired with Greco-Roman deities and even Celtic origins. And when I say Celtic, that includes northwestern France or Brittany. Where there's a lot of information to interpret here, from an astro-theological context of fish, serpents, and dragons, there's also a cultural interpretation regarding bloodlines from the Middle East and Eurasia entering Europe, also associated with serpentine imagery. That said, for this presentation, let's examine the story from the perspective of anthropologist Dr. Sharona Frederick.
Well, I'm fascinated by the folklore of all of the Celtic countries, and I don't know if you know, but now you do, that when I say the Celtic countries, part of that includes northwestern France. Is that clear to you? So when we talk about northwestern France, we have an amazing area there called Brittany, or Bretagne, right? And Brittany is part of the Celtic countries. And the story that we're going to analyze and take apart in all of its funny taffy-like substance, Melusine, or Melusina, as I grew up calling her in Spanish, she is a Celtic legend. The Celtic culture includes northwestern France, and frankly it also includes a lot of northwestern Spain. So you'll find the Melusine story, which finally comes into English at the very beginning of the early modern period, or what you can call the Renaissance in 1500, you'll find the Melusine story very widespread throughout the Celtic countries. That means you'll find this story everywhere, in Ireland, Wales, Brittany in northwestern France, Galicia in northwestern Spain, but you'll also find it all over England, because once that translation was made in 1500, from Old French and from Old Irish, in which the story had also been written, into English, it became a much loved, if indeed one of the creepiest, of all fairy tales. So we have the English language Melusine in 1500, but actually one of the most popular versions of the Melusine legend, and we're also going to be looking at that tonight, is the German version. Because a version came into mid-15th century Germany where the Melusine character became so popular that she became an unofficial saint of the Catholic Church in Germany. And even more interesting than that, following Germany's profound religious schisms in the 16th century, when we had the great and very terrible battles between Lutheranism and the Catholic Church, both Protestants and Catholics in Germany continued the custom, which actually you can still see in rural areas in Bavaria, of leaving offerings to Melusine, who became, in a popular sense, associated with the poor and the indigent. So she goes from being a rather bizarre two-tailed mermaid to being the patron saint, still with her two tails, of the poor and the indigent. She becomes a much loved figure despite her monstrosity. You see here is an image of a count by the name of Raymondine looking at Melusine in her toilette as she puts herself together looking beautiful for him. But unfortunately, he has come on the one day that he's not supposed to come and see her, which is on a Saturday. And we'll see why that is, because this legend, welcome to everybody coming in, come in, sit down. This legend has many ramifications to it. When I was a child, I used to think that there was something vaguely anti-Semitic about the legend. I am of Judeo-Spanish background, what you call a Sephardic Jew, descended from the Jews who were expelled from Imperial Spain in 1492. And every time I would read Saturday, I would think, well, wait a minute, that's Shabbat in Jewish tradition. That's our day of rest. Why is Raymondine prohibited from seeing her on Shabbat? And my questions regarding some of the Jewish origins of the legend fuse with the Celtic origins of the legend, fuse with the Germanic origins of the legend. So we get a story that imbibes from at least five different cultures. Okay? There are German elements. There are Sephardic Jewish from the south of France elements. The larger picture is a Celtic matrix from Brittany. There are French elements which are not Celtic, because France, of course, has many nationalities in it. Are you aware of that? To be French is also to belong to different groups. You can be Catalan French. You can come from Languedoc and be French. There are many different ways to be French. So we have elements that come in from Paris, from the medieval storytellers of Paris, and those elements are not Celtic. We have many English medieval elements and English early modern elements. Early modern folks, think 1492 to the very end of the 18th century. That's usually, maybe you grew up with that being called the Renaissance. I grew up with that being called the Renaissance too, until historians started realizing that you don't call a time period of religious warfare, slavery, and the Spanish Inquisition a Renaissance. So we call it the early modern period. Okay, and there are also many elements from Irish and Welsh legends that have come into the story. This is the glory of the folkloric tradition. Okay, and when the folkloric tradition was dying out in the 19th century, there were two brothers who went around Germany. Do you know who I'm talking about? The brothers Grimm. Literally collecting what was considered worthless stories. Thank heavens they did that, because thanks to the inspiration from the brothers Grimm, we got Lady Gregory doing the same thing in Ireland. We got Nathan Aschubel doing the same thing among Ashkenazic and Sephardic Jews. We got Andrew Lang doing the same thing all over the world, in China and West Africa. Don't let this tradition die. This comes from the oral tradition. The source is the story called Melusine the Siren, first written down in the mid-14th century by Jean, in French, J-E-A-N, d'Arras, D-A-R-R-A-S. That is the first summation of this story that had been rolling around different cultures and different countries, beginning in the Celtic area, rolling around, and ending in the Celtic area, meaning Brittany, Ireland, and Wales. So northwestern France, Ireland, and Wales, in the mid-14th century. Okay, so that's the origin, and that is really how we know of this story, though later on, again, the brothers Grimm will locate a whole bunch of tales about Melusine in rural Germany, and then that will also spark interest in what turned out to be the German written versions of the Melusine legend that actually go back to the late 15th century. Okay, now, does Melusine, who is a two-tailed mermaid, have any basis in fact? If she does, I'm going to scream. I think that would be rather frightening. But I want you to understand that she is viewed as the scion, the origin of the royal household of two places. The first is Luxembourg. The Duchy of Luxembourg. Are you familiar with Luxembourg? Teeny tiny little country, right? In Europe. With a vanishing bridge. At least that is what it is, one of the many things it's famous for. It's supposed to have a bridge that appears only once every 7 years and then disappears. And if you see that. But the entire household of the Duchy of Luxembourg traces its ancestry back to Melusine. But she is very much viewed as the founder of that dynasty in the early Middle Ages. When I say that term, I'm referring to around the 10th century. Okay, so she's viewed as a real character by some. Now, that same house that she was believed to have been Finn, the founder of the House of Lusignan, actually did run an entire island in the period of the Third and Fourth Crusades, that's about the 12th and the 13th century, on the island of Cyprus. So lo and behold, if any of you go to the island of Cyprus, you're going to find that just as in Luxembourg, Melusine is viewed as a real character and as the founder of these dynasties. And this is particularly interesting, folks, because are you aware of the fact usually a woman is not credited with founding a dynasty in Western Europe? That generally belongs to men. This is how you can tell the Celtic origins of this story, because Celtic society stressed, I don't want to tell you it was completely matriarchal, but it stressed very much personages of strong women and of women founders as well as male founders. And so that's one of the many giveaways regarding the Celtic origins of this northwestern French story. Now, Melusine's story, in a much more innocent form, will also be the origin of Hans Christian Andersen's Little Mermaid. And just by a show of hands, how many of you saw the Disney film of The Little Mermaid? It was a very, very nice film. How many of you have ever read Henderson's story of The Little Mermaid? Okay, a little less, but still. His story is very tragic. His story absolutely rips your guts out. It is a tragedy with no happy resolution. And Andersen, although he toned down the more monstrous parts of the story, Melusine is looking very pretty there. We know that when she transforms one day a week, she's pretty horrific looking. Although he tones down the uglier aspects of the story for the sake of the children that he was writing for, Andersen had a very great social conscience, this magnificent Danish writer of the 19th century, and the Melusine story interested him because it was for him a model of the difficulties with which different cultural groups cannot come together. That's what he was seeing in 19th century Europe. I think we can see this, unfortunately, all over the world. So Melusine, or the Little Mermaid, as he renames her, becomes the symbol of the outsider. Right, who's willing to do anything to be accepted, except, you know, if you've read the story, there's no happy ending there. She dies. Okay? Which is a little bit of a sign of what would happen when you would do anything to be accepted, because cultural diffusion has to go both ways, right? You have to give and you have to get. And she gives and she doesn't get anything. So that is the origin of Andersen's story. By the way, that is not at all my theory. Andersen left many letters in which he spoke about his interest in European folklore in general, and his rewritings of many of these stories had a lot to do with the social meanings that Andersen found in those stories. So Melusine plays an important part in the stories of Hans Christian Andersen. Yes, and thank you.
Is it the same mermaid used on Starbucks symbol?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And you're going to see that in Kendra's Power. Yes, so now, that was a dreadful question to ask, because now you're going to see Melusine literally following you every time you have a latte. And it is a little bit odd to me, although I'm sure that Starbucks, since this is being filmed, let me just say this in case one of Starbucks' lawyers is there in the audience. I'm assuming Starbucks made some sort of agreement with the House of Lusignan, which still exists, by the way, the descendants of the House of Lusignan, because that is specifically the Starbucks image comes from an earlier 15th century woodcut. Okay, of the kind of ghastly, smiling mermaid with two tails. So the first time that shows up in Seattle back in 1991, right, in Pike's Coffee House, I don't know if they'd asked for the copyright at that point, but that image was not one they'd invented. It was one they had transposed, that specific image. Thank you very much for asking that question. Anything else? Please don't feel embarrassed. Yes? So that's a fantastic question, and that question emphasizes the blurring that I was mentioning with Anderson. If you read Jean Daras's actual text from the 14th century, make no mistake about it, that is supposed to be one heck of an ugly, frightening serpent's tail divided in two.
Study the sea serpent Nagas in the Eastern culture.
So the stories of Melusine, when they become a very firm part of Western folklore in the 16th century, and then go out to the New World, where everybody knows I eventually bring people, because that's really my specialty, and we'll see what happens to Melusine when she gets to the French colonies in the New World. The stories of the Nagas, which are the kind of serpent sirens from India, and also water deities, are taken to the New World because the Portuguese who get to the New World have first colonized parts of India. Remember? Vasco da Gama gets there first. But the Portuguese, like their cousins the Spanish, have a whole large New World empire. And when the whole thing is taken over by Spain in 1580, all of that folklore merges together. And you can go into churches, colonial churches in Brazil, and see images of the Naga that look like Melusine. Because Spain was a big country at that point, and it had taken over so much of the New World, it also was invading French territory. Notice Melusine has a mirror, because Melusine was supposed to be very beautiful. She was the daughter of a water nymph, a Celtic water nymph associated all over with wells and springs in northwestern France. Her mother's name was Pressina, and Pressina fell in love with the king of Albion. Anybody know what country Albion would be? Okay, it's always mistranslated as Albania, and that makes the story rather odd. If you read that and think it's Albania, you'll think, whoa, the story really got around. The White Cliffs of Albion. Thank you, England. Okay, and this goes back to the early Celtic period in English history, or the period when the Celts and the Saxons were fighting each other between the 5th to the early 9th century. So Pressina, who's Celtic, French Celtic, falls in love with the king of Albion. They have three daughters. One of them is Melusine, and her two sisters, Melior and Palatine. And everything is positively groovy. Everything is wonderful between Pressina and Albion, except that she has imposed one strict obligation on Albion, that he can never see her when she is nursing her triplets, one of whom is Melusine. I have to point out that whenever fairy folk, supernatural sprites like Pressina, marry a mortal, there will always be these issues involved. Are you familiar with the word taboo? Okay, so there will always be a taboo. There will always be a rule that cannot be broken, and when it's broken, it will lead to dreadful, dreadful consequences. Well, one day Albion breaks in on Pressina, and that ends that marriage. And she takes the three daughters off with her to the Isle of Avalon. Do you know that isle from any other place? Where? King who? King Arthur. And that also points up the Celtic patronymic of this story. Avalon in Celtic, Irish and Welsh and Northwestern French tradition represents paradise. What it actually means in 5th century Cymric, the language which is still spoken in Wales, although not in its 5th century version, is literally Island of Apples. It's a symbol of paradise. And Pressina takes her three daughters, Melior, Melusine, and Palatine, off to Avalon, and they grow up in Avalon. And when Melusine is 15, and she's a very beautiful young woman, always admiring herself in the mirror, she asks her mom, "Mom, why do we know who Dad is?" And Pressina says, "There's a reason. There's a reason. He broke the taboo." And she breaks down and tells Melusine, Melior, and Palatine the story of how Albion had broken the taboo. And Melior, Melusine's sister, says, "Well, that doesn't sound so bad. Mom, it sounds like he was curious, nothing more." And Palatine says, "Yes, I think we should see our father, King Albion." And Melusine's very quiet. She doesn't say anything because Melusine is actually confabulating some type of revenge. And the next evening at twilight, think of twilight, crossroads, times when times which are considered portals to a kind of supernatural world, Melusine goes off and finds the King of Albion. Yeah, she shouldn't have done this. This is her problem. She was a little too impulsive. And she takes the King of Albion and walls him up in a high tower to punish him for having hurt her mother. Now, this is interesting. She goes back. Look at what the story tells us about human relations. She goes back to Avalon thinking that her mother will be very pleased with her, right? See, you know, I punished our dad for not listening to you. Instead, Prasina flies into a rage. She's a rather unpleasant character in the story. And she smacks Melusine thrice, all right? Always the number three, another very sacred number, to a certain degree connected with the idea of the Trinity. But remember, a lot of these stories are from a pre-Christian era. So they're also connected with the idea of the Morrigu. In Celtic tradition, the three-headed female muse, or shall I say rather three female muses stuck together who revolved as though they were one body. She slaps her three times and she says, Melusine, you will never be forgiven for what you have done to me, and your curse will be double. Now, we generally only remember the first part of the curse, but there's a very great writer in Argentina, Manuel Mujica Lainez, who took up the second part of the curse, which is a little bit more difficult to deal with. I'll tell you about that in a minute. We remember the first part of the curse. And the first part of the curse that Prasina puts on her daughter Melusine, who again was trying to make her mother happy, right? She says, you are already the most beautiful of my daughters. I cannot take your beauty from you. But what I can do, and I will do, is make one day a week, and it will be the seventh day in which you will turn into a monster. And if you find a man who can love you despite that monstrosity, you may marry him. You may, in fact, marry someone without telling him of your monstrosity, but your union, your marriage, will end the minute he sees that monstrosity. And so she gives Melusine the horrible curse of the serpent's tail. So now take a look at the first. We have the first image, which is a bit nicer. The second image is both more sexual and more creepy. Yeah? Because there you see the beautiful woman with a really snaky tail. Now, because Prasina was a water nymph and they went off to the Isle of Avalon, Melusine and her sisters live in the water. But Melusine can also live on land because for 6 days a week, she's a human being. What are the curses given to her other two sisters? One is to be walled up in a castle until the end of days. Prasina's kind of the mother from hell. And the other one is to become invisible altogether. So she is not a nice woman. Manuel Mujica Lainez, the Argentine writer, wrote about the second curse that Prasina gives Melusine, because when Melusine is going through absolute torture because of this horrible curse, she cries out to her mother and says, Mother, I will do anything for you. Please give me another body. And this is the part that our writer, Mujica Lainez, takes up. Prasina appears and she says, Melusine, you want another body? Okay, I'll give you another body. And she gives her a man's body. And she leaves her with a woman's spirit in a man's body. Melusine grows up, you know, and she's a spectacularly beautiful woman except one day a week. And so what she does, she leaves the Isle of Avalon and she goes to inhabit all of the wells and creeks and anything connected with water and the coastline of Brittany in northwestern France. She's a very common figure in northwestern France, and you will see her image on many, many places. She is credited with leaving food for the poor, and she generally stays by fountains, and because she is so spectacularly beautiful, men fall in love with her, and because she has no reason to trust any mortal man, She will flirt with them, she will sometimes make love to them, and then she will disappear. She doesn't trust any man with loving her enough to be able to not ask her secret of where she goes on Saturday and why she must completely disappear on Saturday. In the French story, she meets a Count Raymondine of the House of Lusignan, and for the first time she falls in love with a man. And she decides to do something till that point she has not done, which is offer herself in marriage. And she does to Raymondine. And they fall madly in love, except this weird taboo exists that one day a week he may not see her. And again, that day is very suggestively Saturday, and I just say this because if you want to take a look at medieval European folklore, which often has very weird attitudes towards people of other religions, there was a great deal of suspicion against Jews for having a different Sabbath than Christians. And so, because our Sabbath is on a Saturday and the Christian Sabbath is on a Sunday, this was something that often raised eyebrows, except you're going to find that most of the racism or anti-religious bias tends to come more from the upper classes. The lower classes generally really didn't care very much whom you prayed to. And so it's a not unsympathetic attitude towards Melusine. And Raymondine says, well, you know what? You want Saturday off? I'll let you have it. And they have three children, except the tragedy is each of the children is born terribly deformed. Now, is anybody aware of attitudes towards the deformed in late medieval Europe? They were pretty horrible. And by the way, this continues into the early modern period. Have you ever heard of the word bedlam? This is total bedlam. This is craziness. Right. Bedlam was a ditch in England, which later became an ersatz mental asylum, where people with deformities or people with mental infirmities were thrown into the ditch. And other people would go and laugh at them, including a very cultured English poet from what we used to call the Renaissance, Sir Philip Sidney, who said, quote unquote, "We laugh at deformity." That's very ugly, isn't it? Melusine is a counterweight to that, because Melusine is supposed to have loved her children and to have stopped Count Raymondine from killing the children when they were born deformed. So Melusine also becomes the patroness of people who had physical deformities. That's very powerful in cultures that did not accept physical deformities. When the story was translated into German in the late 15th century, and take a look at the slide closer to my hand, it's a very, very powerful image. Notice the look of terror on Melusine's face. She does not want her German knight, who is the one she meets after Raymondine, basically betrays her. When he comes in and spies on her when she's in her bath one Saturday and screams when he sees the serpent's tail, and he expels her from the Lusignan castle in Poitou, and she turns into a dragon and goes up into the air shrieking and promises that she will appear flying in the sky, the sea serpent in the sky, 3 days before the death of any member of the House of Lusignan. Okay, so this relationship did not end well. She goes off to the forests of Germany, and there, in the German version, she meets a German knight who is supposed to be an older man. Okay, so he's finally grown up. Take a look at the image, because he is portrayed as being older. And although he is horrified when he accidentally sees Melusine transforming into the two-tailed serpent, unlike Raymondine, he decides to keep her and to be a good husband to her. And the problem is that Melusine does not trust him enough to keep the taboo, even though he has done so. And in one of her most unwise moments, she decides he's not to be trusted because she's convinced she is simply too horrible for him to look at, and she leaves him. Now, he goes mad because he loves her, but after she's gone for a number of years, he has to remarry because he is a knight. He has to make sure that he has some sort of issue. It could be biological, it could be adopted, but he needs somebody to inherit his property. And he calls for Melusine to come back, and she doesn't. And so he remarries. And then Melusine appears at the wedding. This is one of the most frightening images of the Melusine legend. Just as he, the German knight, and his new wife are about to consecrate their marriage with a kiss, they see a snake tail in the window, and a little bit of blood drips down from the ceiling, and the German knight realizes that is Melusine come back. This is a very moving story. The German knight goes outside and sees Melusine sitting threateningly on the rooftop and says, Melusine, my dear, you know I always loved you and you abandoned me. Would you kill me now in death? Would you leave me with no sons? He said, I wanted to adopt your sons. You didn't allow me to do that. Are you going to kill my bride? And Melusine realizes she's made a mistake. She's becoming as vengeful in an unjustified way with this young woman as her mother was with her. And so Melusine leaves her German knight with, I think, the saddest goodbye. That's not Auf Wiedersehen, right? Because Auf Wiedersehen, we see each other again. This is just so long. And she disappears forever. But all throughout Germany, there are wells consecrated to her that continue to be consecrated to this day. Okay, so she's a very interesting character in terms of representing the eternal outsider. Now, this part of France, northwestern France, Brittany, is very, very different to the rest of France because it is Celtic. The Celtic tradition of Brittany places it as the resting place of Arthur's magician and prophet and advisor. Who am I talking about? Merlin. Exactly, because Brittany is the place where the sea nymph Nimue, or the sea nymph Vivian, or by some tokens, Melusine's two sisters, Melior and Palatine, seduced Merlin and walled him up in a rock in Brittany, which is still shown to tourists as the rock where Merlin is sleeping. But Merlin has to sleep a certain amount of years because Merlin, I don't know if you know this, lives backwards. So he's supposed to have been born at the age of 10,000. He gets younger every year, and he will supposedly wake up and move that rock in Brittany when he reaches the ripe young age of 100. So this is an area steeped in Celtic folklore, and in the Western Celtic tradition, the tradition of the west of Ireland, the northwest of France, and to a certain degree Wales, the Western Ocean always plays a very big part. In Celtic tradition, paradise is always in the Western Ocean, whether it's Avalon, the island of apples of the Welsh Celts, or Tir na n'Og, which interestingly enough also appears for the French Celts in Brittany and, of course, Ireland, the land of eternal youth. It's always set in the West. And this is the area to which Melusine goes in the legend after she messes up what could have been a good relationship with her German knight. She goes to the oceans of the West and she forms a pact with Manannan MacLir, Manannan, the son of the sea god Lir. In this pact, we're going to see Melusine can also sometimes find, dare I say, marital satisfaction, because guess what? There are male sirens and female sirens. There are mermen and merwomen. And so we have an entire colony of these rather odd sea people who, some like Melusine, can walk on land when they so wish, at least 6 days a week, and some who cannot. In the Americas, many of the native peoples, including the Mayan Indians, and even the Aztecs who were much more landlocked, and the Inca Indians on the Pacific, in the mountains of Peru, who also went across to the Pacific, to Easter Island, they had their own stories of women who were half human and half fish or half serpent. And when the Melusine stories travel with Breton and Irish sailors to the New World, the traditions will fuse. So in the back, of course, you have an image of a ship called the Flying Dutchman, which is supposedly a 17th century ship manned by a Dutch sailor who was trying to get around the coast of what is now South Africa and told the crew on a stormy night, "You will not jump this ship. You will not leave me alone. You will never jump this ship." And then, of course, it becomes a ghost story. Nobody could jump the ship. And the ship became the ghostly Flying Dutchman, which continues to round the southern coast of South Africa, and sometimes sails out to the New World. And it's sighted in the Caribbean, and it's sighted in the Pacific, and it's sighted anywhere where pirates have had a lot of rum and time to tell stories. Nothing has been as good for the folkloric process as rum. So Melusine, with that name, starts turning up in maritime sea lore. In the late 16th and early 17th century, she has swum out to the New World. And we have a stunningly beautiful image here by the American illustrator Howard Pyle. If you don't know Howard Pyle, do please Google him. Fantastic illustrator of all Celtic legends, King Arthur, and many, many others. And we have an image here of Melusine in the typical siren's role. She lures the sailors to her, and then she kills them. Well, is that a nice thing to do? You see, in the New World, she's given a bit of, a judicial role. She metes out justice to men who have not treated women well. There you see her, that must be on a Saturday when her tail is in its full glory. And Melusine will punish those who rape women. She will punish those who mistreat women. Now, in the Hebrides, in northern Scotland, where we have folklore connected with the Norse, with the Celts, and with anybody else who happened to be in that area, these stories from the Hebrides turn up in Jamaica in the early 17th century. And in those stories, Melusine will ride the manatee, which is interesting because that's, you know, this is a New World creature, no manatees in the Old World. And the manatee is every bit as supernatural as Melusine because the manatee will actually bring those sailors who need to be punished directly to Melusine. Now, can you not hug that? Right? Isn't that incredibly cute? Okay, but this manatee may be cute, but he's no jerk, okay? So the manatee follows the sailors who have done wrong, and he will bring them to Melusine and her New World cousins. If you take a look at the first image, well, the image closer to my hand, it says the mermaid asks for the king's child. This is a very famous variant on the Melusine legend that you will find in Argentina in the 16th, 17th, and into the 18th century. And it's part of a story that Manuel Mujica Lainez wrote called La Sirena, the Siren, in which the Melusine character pops up and tries to impede the conquest of Rio de la Plata, the Silver River, which Spain is embarking upon, and she seduces the captain of the ship. The Melusine character, by the time you get to the early 18th century, was so well known in the New World that many people didn't realize it had actually originated in northwestern France and the Old World. In those colonies conquered by France, the legend came. And here's where Brazil comes into it. Does that strike you as weird? Brazil, it wasn't conquered by France. Okay, now wake up to one of the oddest bits of French history. Go online and Google France in 16th century Brazil. And you will find that there was a huge effort by France to colonize Brazil in the 16th century. Okay, and it was called Antarctic France. Okay? France down in the south. And there was a very, very important French colony run by somebody named Jean de Lery in 16th century Brazil. Most of those people were French Protestants, Huguenots, fleeing religious persecution in France. Many were also Catholic, and all of them brought the story of Melusine. And it is not accidental that in the areas colonized by France in Brazil, later we have the story of Yara. And Yara combines the Melusine story, Melusine as a wronged female, with another element. Yara has been raped by her brothers. And Yara, who is Melusine as well, now sits and waits for all sailors who have dared to mistreat women, and she will bring them down to the depths. And finally, at the end, here we come. Starbucks. They didn't invent that logo. And their first coffee shop in Seattle in the early 90s used this two-tailed mermaid. Now, Melusine is the only mermaid in Western folklore who has a split tail. And when she travels to the New World, to Brazil, to Haiti, to everywhere she gets in the New World, that split tail is always the sign of Melusine. What is the connection between that and your latte? I'll be damned if I can tell you. I will tell you one thing that seems to be said a lot in popular media, which is that in the corporate world there is, and this probably won't surprise many of you, there's a lot of interest in mysticism. You know that Wall Street boys are very famous for frequenting fortune tellers in Lower Manhattan. Oh, somebody has to tell you what's going to happen economically. Okay, and there are entire bits of corporate folklore which are very connected to mystical or magical earlier folklore. And as to why she was chosen, I don't know. What I do know is that Starbucks has fully admitted that, yes, this is one of the original shields of the House of Lusignan. That's nice.
My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. Please check out my books available on Amazon. I'd like to say thank you to those who support me on Patreon. There should be a link below. Kindly share and please hit the like button. Don't forget to subscribe. I look forward to reading your thoughts in the comments section. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.